Hi, I'm Mel Majoros. I am a 2-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. Today, we're talking about lymphoma with Carl Schwartz and Liz McMillan. How are you today?
Well, I'm perfectly fine. I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. So, Liz, why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about your survivorship story, your dealings with cancer.
Well, I was diagnosed with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in 2006 and was treated with CHOP-R, which was kind of the standard thing.
Wait, what is that kind of?
CHOP-R, or R-CHOP, depending. You know, some people call it one or the other. It's a chemo regimen.
Oh, okay.
It includes a couple of the things I think you even got for yours.
Oh, probably.
The H in CHOP is actually adriamycin.
Oh.
Our favorite, right?
So they can't spell because that starts with an A.
No, it has three different ways of saying it. I'm not even going to go into it. But that's the chemical name, actually. One of them starts with an A. You know, one way to say it starts with an H.
I see.
So I went through that. I was diagnosed on a fluke, which is not uncommon for a lot of lymphoma, especially non-Hodgkin's lymphoma patients. I have an autoimmune disease, sarcoidosis, and was going in for an annual look at my lungs. And they spotted something that really shouldn't have been there. And it turned out to be very early stage diffuse large B-cell, which was determined through a biopsy.
And lymphoma, for people who don't know, is a blood cancer, correct?
It's a blood cancer. There's a lymphoma, leukemia, and myeloma are the principal blood cancers. There are about 60,000. Lymphomas are relatively rare. Hodgkin's is one type of lymphoma. Non-Hodgkin's is the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great to be a non-Hodgkin's person because how would you, you know, your disease is defined as being not something else. So I'm a little sensitive to that. I mean, just like a mother doesn't really want to be called a non-father.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Let's have our own designation, but we don't. We're just non-Hodgkin's. Hodgkin's, there's probably about 8,000 people a year who are diagnosed in the U.S., and non-Hodgkin's, I think, is closer to 60,000 a year. Is that correct, Carl?
That's about it, yes. Altogether, about 70, 75,000 lymphomas per year. It's more common than leukemias, even though it's less well-known.
Well, we want to get rid of all of these, let's be honest.
Yes.
I was talking to one of my other guests a couple weeks ago, and I said, I'd like to put us out of a job.
Indeed.
You know?
Sounds like a worthy goal.
So Liz, you were diagnosed in 2006. Now you're currently in remission or cancer-free or no evidence of disease or whatever they want to call it.
Well, yeah. I'm almost 4 years out. It'll be September.
Great.
And actually with the aggressive lymphomas, once you get past the 2-year mark, your chances of relapsing get very, very, very low, pretty minuscule.
Good. Excellent.
So the traditional kind of 5-year mark that people use for solid cancers, like breast or lung or colon, mm-hmm. doesn't really hold, I don't think. I don't think it's really a fair one for lymphomas. Because some people with the indolent or slow-growing lymphomas, such as follicular or MALT, can go many, many years and relapse later. And then the aggressive ones, actually, you know, if you get past that 2-year mark, you can get pretty comfortable. You can start breathing again.
Well, I think we all feel that way, though. You know, 5 years out, 10 years out, you still get nervous about any kind of scan or test.
Yeah,
or anything.
Scanxiety, as we call
mm-hmm.
it.
Scanxiety. I told somebody about that, or scanophobia.
Yeah.
So, Carl, I know that you're not a survivor, but you're a caregiver. I'd like to hear your story.
Sure, and Liz, her introduction helps with mine because Joanne was diagnosed with indolent lymphoma, follicular type.
And that's your wife?
Yes,
okay.
And she was diagnosed in 1996, and it's a non-aggressive type, and it tends to be very difficult to cure, challenging to cure.
Well, how is it non-aggressive and difficult to cure?
It may be that because the cells are not always in cell cycle, you know, not always dividing rapidly, not as sensitive. There are some tumor cells that will escape chemotherapy, which acts more readily on dividing cells. That's one theory. Really, we don't know why it's so challenging to cure, but there are cases where people have very durable remissions that suggest the cure.
Right.
So in Joanne's case, she was diagnosed with indolent type, and she was advised to watch and wait, sometimes called watch and worry.
Really?
And, yeah, but her indolent lymphoma didn't behave very indolently. It progressed steadily. And it shortly after it really took off, and which is called, it was suspected of transforming to aggressive, which means some of the cells become aggressive. And so basically you have two lymphomas. You have an indolent component and an aggressive.
Oh, wow.
So she had CHOP therapy, and that was before Rituxan in 1997. And so I don't have to describe what CHOP is. That's already been done.
Yes, thanks,
but it's,
Liz.
It's an aggressive therapy, and she did have a complete response.
Oh, good.
But unfortunately, it only lasted 6 months.
Oh.
So that was pretty devastating. We were encouraged and then greatly deflated. And from that point, she had Rituxan as a single therapy, which is I don't know if you want me to go into.
Sure, go ahead.
What that is. It's an antibody, like your body creates antibodies against infection.
Okay.
But it's man-made, and it's designed to bind to mature B cells.
Okay.
Malignant or not. So this little receptor on those cells targets, and it binds to it, and sometimes it directly kills the cell, and sometimes it induces the immune system to. But in her case, she wasn't responsive to that. So she had a little minor response, but it was not very much. Then she went into a clinical trial in the year 2000, another antibody. Then she tried also Rituxan with a chemotherapy called Pepsi, P-E-P-C. No need to go into the details of that, except that it's low oral. It was an oral type chemo. She took it at home, and it was low dose. And she took it for almost a month, every day, a small amount, small dose. And she responded to that, but not a complete response. So she had a lot of therapies and other clinical trials, but it came apparent that it was 2004 that she was needing a lot of therapy, and how much of this can she take of the same therapy and still get a benefit. And often the response would be there, but before her hair grew back, she needed more treatment. So not a good situation. So again, she did the low-dose oral therapy to reduce the burden a little bit, followed by a high-dose therapy, Cytoxan.
Right.
And with that, stem cell harvesting, just in case she needed a stem cell transplant. And in my mind, I was thinking that this was probably in our future. It was pretty difficult. Just the number of relapses were so many, and I was thinking that that was where we were heading. But before that, we tried to follow that high-dose Cytoxan with Bexxar, which is like the antibody I noted before, except with a radio-labeled. It's radio-labeled. It has an isotope. So it delivers radiation.
I call it turbocharged antibody.
Anti-radio immunotherapy, they call it. And Bexxar is one of them.
Zevalin
is another.
I've heard of that.
More people should hear about it, because after 8 years, then what happens?
That's a therapy that is struggling to survive, actually. But so now here we are. That's in 2005. She had that therapy, and she's had no detectable disease since then.
Oh, excellent.
So you compare the first primary aggressive therapy, a 6-month remission, with now a 5-year and counting remission. So we are just incredibly grateful to be where we are. And noting that I realize that any individual experience doesn't really predict what others would have with the same therapy, but it isn't. I feel a very encouraging story, and we're just very grateful.
Right. Well, I'm glad that she's still with us.
Indeed.
And that led you to create Patients Against Lymphoma?
Her diagnosis did indirectly, like most everyone we used the internet to, and we found each other on support forums and such. And my background in IT and web site design just sort of led to creating a place to put frequently asked questions. And one thing led to another, and we founded Patients Against Lymphoma. Our, I guess you might say that the need for our group, we define as we needed a group that was really just patient-centered, that wasn't beholden to any pharmaceutical groups or health industry or vitamin companies, just so that no one could question what, about the content, whether it was in part based on that. and we wanted it to be evidence-based and to help people understand all of their options and what questions they should ask of their doctors and when to consider trials and so on.
And you started this right after in 1996?
Patients Against Lymphoma was founded in 2004.
2004.
Although as I began as an I became an advocate early with NCI and with FDA in 2001 actually I started to work as a consultant to FDA on the patient representative program.
I heard the phone.
And Carl is also, Carl sits on ODAC,
which is
the Oncology Drug Advisory Committee. If you read in the paper from time to time when there's a drug and it'll say you know 6-4, 9-0, whatever. The committee voted to recommend a certain drug, and then a couple months later, the FDA will usually, you know, then approve a drug for marketing to all patients of that condition. So that committee of scientists, representatives from the drug industry, healthcare providers, bioethicists, and well-trained patient representatives are the people who make those initial recommendations. And Carl sits on ODAC.
Oh, excellent.
Those lymphoma drugs that are coming down the pipeline, Carl's got something to do with that.
Well, we do have a vote, but one minor correction: the industry isn't part of the advisory group. They would be MDs and lymphoma specialists, depending on the indication, whatever.
But there are researchers coming out of pharma, though. They're not industry like the sponsors, but.
No, actually, that would be make it difficult to get on the advisory board. If you have any conflict of interest, for example, you couldn't be on the advisory board.
So
but
strictly
the,
academic
but the industry
researcher.
Makes its case. It's almost like a trial, a criminal case where you know the sponsor makes its case about the data of a study that they're presenting for marketing approval, and then the FDA raises its questions. The issues that it finds based, you know, maybe there was some aspect of it that was misleading or some element of the design that was biased and created, it really wasn't as good as it looked, for example. So both sides make their case, and then the advisory committee asks questions, and then they make their decision.
So your website is?
Lymphomation.org.
Lymphomation.org.
Lymphoma, T-I-O-N.org.
So do you have a lot of people come to you, whether on Facebook or on the website, and ask a lot of questions about lymphoma?
Yes, I'm happy to say we have a recent statistic. What was it? 111,000 unique visitors in March.
Oh, wow.
So we do. The content is really based on, since we started it, just based on questions that came mainly from the support forums, and that created a topic page, and then we populated the topic page with perspectives or links to sites that answer that question. Day by day, questions that came up or perspectives that were interesting, determine what was put on Lymphomation.
Right.
And that's actually how I found PAL.
Oh.
Patients Against Lymphoma was trying to research my own condition and, you know, understand, you know, what I was up against. And of all the lymphoma sites, I could really tell this one was being written by somebody who intimately knew the disease.
Right.
You could really tell. And they ran Yahoo groups at that point. and I became a member of one of the support groups because I'm a couple hours outside of New York City and an hour and a half away from Stony Brook University, which is where I received my treatment.
Okay.
So it wasn't all that easy, especially during chemo. You know how exhausted you get. It wasn't all that easy for me to attend support groups. I didn't do it all that often. And these small groups that Carl ran through PAL, I joined the diffuse large B-cell group, and they were just a lifeline for me.
And then
I kind of graduated and then began to help the other people coming in who were newly diagnosed be able to give back, which becomes, I think, important for some people.
It does.
As a way of emotionally healing.
Is this a live chat that you have on Lymphomation? Or your
young? That was an email group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, email-based. It's a lot more sophisticated with what Liz runs now on Facebook. It's just amazing
right. How
interactive it is and how different types of media and pictures and video can be utilized. So, yeah, it was just these email-based websites still are very active, but they tend to be not so much chatty, but, use it when you have a question and or patients will use it for updates on their test results and what does this mean.
Right, and when I was diagnosed, I didn't know anything about Facebook. So I went to, like you said, great sites for me was like breastcancer.org, but I wish I'd known about Facebook at the time. And Liz and I had talked before the show, we always talking about being proactive about your own health. And I have a funny story. My doctor told me the day I was diagnosed, I said, I'm going to look up what I have on the internet. And she looked at me.
Probably said, oh, no.
Yeah, she said, maybe you should wait a little while. And I was like, no, I was thinking, well, I can handle anything. And, of course, you type in invasive ductal carcinoma, and then there's these pictures, and they give you, all the standard course of treatment. And then after about 5 minutes, I had to shut the computer off, and my fiance looked at me and goes, why didn't you listen to your doctor? I mean, sometimes too much information can be, I think when you're first diagnosed, it might be a little scary.
Well, especially when it's unbuffered like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet doctors, don't tell you the good thing, which is that you actually should, rather than randomly going about the internet, which, depending upon your skill level, is probably going to net you more bad information than it will good. And it certainly will get you a lot of information for which you have no context or bearing to understand.
Right.
But, good patient education and navigation organizations, are an invaluable resource. Most of them have some kind of a helpline.
Oh, yes.
Or, some way to get in touch with them. And they are a terrific way because they have time to teach you about what's going on and connect you with other patients who are going through it. Many organizations will match you with a cancer buddy or cancer mentor, peer-to-peer matching programs. The Lymphoma Research Foundation does that. They're big enough, and they have chapters both in Canada and the U.S. And so they can match someone up with someone who has the same diagnosis and similar life circumstances, such as someone, also a mom of 35 or also a teenager in college or, what I mean?
Exactly. Well, this was like the second.
Somebody who knows what you're going through.
This was like the second day that I knew. So it wasn't like, the hospital did help me out that way and I did get information, but it was just like, well, I'll find out on my own. And then, your head.
Wham.
Your head kind of explodes and spins off like a top going.
All of a sudden, you've been led straight to the ninth circle of hell.
I'm thinking that that's a very common circumstance. The first post for people on the support forums is I ask my oncologist what my prognosis is. Well, how long what's my survival?
Right.
And sometimes the doctor will provide the median survival for the type of lymphoma. It might be might be 7 years, and that is interpreted to mean I have 7 years to live.
Right.
And which is, so one of the first conversations we have is that, no,
right.
It doesn't mean that. It's just, what statistics mean and that it's a middle point, and it tells you what curve you're on, but not where you are on that curve.
Exactly.
That kind of thing. The other issue with lymphomas is they tend to occur in older people, so the statistic for the population, overall population, is going to be skewed by the starting age. I mean, what is the median survival for anyone who is 65 years old?
Well, that's true.
And they don't tell you that. The median survival includes everybody who happened to get hit by a motorcycle or have a stroke.
That's right. It's death from any cause, not so. That, it's really used to compare and to see if progress is being made. The median was this in 1970. It's this in 2000. It's not for prognosis.
But, it doesn't work for individuals.
Physicians sometimes forget. Maybe they don't have time. I think probably the one reasons we exist is that consult times are so short. Physicians are pressed for time.
Well,
and there's not a lot of time for explanation.
And I think as a patient, you need to make sure that they give you that time.
Yeah, yeah.
But they really kind of can't. And certain doctors aren't even that well equipped just by temperament and their own inclinations. They're just not that good at explaining it.
But you know what? I tell people this, if you're diagnosed and if you're not sure, if you can't bring somebody with you, you know, because your head is always like, oh, my God, I just had...
Paul really advocates that, bringing another set of ears.
If you can't bring somebody, like, say that you're completely alone, buy one of those digital voice recorders. Because we actually did that as well as having, my fiancé Doug was there in the room taking notes and asking questions, and so was I. You know, you could always listen to it later and then ask questions. I always say never be afraid to ask a question to the doctor.
Absolutely. We get an amazing number of letters each day on Facebook. In addition to the inquiries that you probably get through the website, Carl, I mean, we get a lot of numbers. And we actually set up PAL. Now, I have to back up a bit, actually. The PAL Facebook group is less than a year old. Mm-hmm. We started at the end of August of last year. So, and we're about almost 2,700 people now.
Oh, excellent.
And I've actually been trying not to grow because it's just me. So, and we try to respond personally to as much, anything we get. But I set it up as an individual account, not as a group or a fan page, which have morphed in their own ways,
right,
so that people really could chat. You know, you and I, Mel, have chatted
sometimes
online. And so it's set up so people can, and there I frequently get inquiries from very distressed patients who've just been diagnosed with a relapse, or, my daughter, my 15-year-old daughter has just been, diagnosed, or... I get questions all the time from people of an urgent nature.
Right.
And we're glad we're there. That's why people should, rather than troll around the Internet on your own, which, people are welcome to do, of course, but I think a better place to start are with the more personal patient education and advocacy groups.
Correct. But I always say with that, always talk to your doctor as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see stuff on Facebook, and I'm not saying it's your group or anything, but personally, people's opinions are good on Facebook, but they're not a medical doctor.
No, and an advocacy group is a little bit different than just a Facebook group.
Right.
An advocacy organization usually have people with some degree of training and, discipline and care with what they're going to say. They're going to be real responsible. Just other patients, the problem Carl's very involved with the WebMagic groups. They have an excellent Hodgkin's and an excellent non-Hodgkin's discussion forums. There's a lot of well-informed patients on those and caregivers on those groups, but I had a hard time with them because there were so many people who are they don't seem to have much else to do with their lives, and they get on there and make all kinds of outlandish statements. And,
right.
Maybe the fourth or fifth post down the road, you'll get somebody who's knowledgeable and sensible, but exactly what you said. But they will talk as if they're doctors. They will give advice as if it's, if it's the real advice. Whereas in PAL, we like to say, here are these studies.
Right.
Your question has been addressed by these several studies. Why don't, we urge you to print those out and take them with you and discuss them or fax them to your oncologist and see what your oncologist views is of that.
Exactly. But
you'd be surprised how many people don't feel that they can ask basic questions of their oncologist. And then there's always the oncology nurses, too,
right,
especially in multidisciplinary settings. A lot of the big centers, this is not true, Carl, are going the multidisciplinary route where a lot of people, and someone for like breast cancer, that's ideal because you are going to have probably rads and surgery and chemo. Whereas with the blood cancers, surgery is generally not that common.
Right.
It's rare when you get, sometimes, you are... have your disease at advance and maybe you need to have your spleen removed or whatever, but generally surgery's not part of the program.
I didn't know that.
and, you know, it's chemo and sometimes radiation. And actually, they probably, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but in, especially in Hodgkin's, they tend to be getting away from radiation as much as possible.
Is that true, Carl?
Yes, that's true. I mean, it's a systemic condition, so it's a blood cell cancer. So removing a lymph node, well, they do that for a biopsy, but sometimes for cosmetic reasons or if it's other reasons. But generally, you get you treat it systemically unless it's caught very early, stage one. You can cure so-called incurable indolent lymphomas even when you get them early, but it's not. Most times it's diagnosed at an advanced stage. But just coming back to your point about asking questions, I think in general, when you get advice, specific advice on the Internet, that's a flag, a red flag that you should take that with a grain of salt. Because
right.
what you're looking for are what questions to bring to your oncologist and maybe... some context so that you can understand what your options are and what to discuss further. But if somebody's giving you advice, you should do this, then that's a signal that you should be wary of that advice, of taking that advice with a grain of salt.
And even...
Well, particularly in the realm of natural remedies
right.
or nutritional supplements,
mm-hmm.
alternative stuff, most of the you know, people would like to believe there's some, quotes, natural way to cure cancer. There really is not. Once a genetic mutation has taken place and a cell has become cancerous, there is no amount of, quotes, unquote, detoxing or antioxidants that you can take that are going to erase or delete that genetic error. I mean, that, once that mutation's there, once cancer is going, what might help to, you know, reduce the incidence of cancer, what might help to, you know, make it less likely for cancer to occur is not going to cure cancer. And the natural remedies that have shown in studies to be effective are ones that mostly treat symptoms, like ginger for nausea, acupuncture for pain, nausea, anxiety,
right.
things like that.
And plus these natural herbs and things, if you're taking chemo, may counteract them. I mean, you should never take anything without talking to your doctor.
Absolutely, exactly. There are several of them that actually interfere with specific chemos, and it gets so complex that most oncologists tell people, just please don't take, you know, excess vitamins. Please don't take supplements during treatment because it's just too difficult to determine what it is you're taking
exactly.
and whether or not. I mean, they know some broad strokes, you know, things are bad to do, but...
And I think that's the point of, you know, your organization is, as well as this show, is we want to tell people to be proactive. And you know what? If you don't like your doctor, I mean, even if you're in a small town, you can get a second opinion. You can ask.
Well, you should get a second opinion even if you do like your doctor.
Right. Well, I'm just saying.
I did. I mean, I happen to adore my oncologist. She's great. But I, you know, wanted to know I was getting, I wanted to know if there were, I really do believe two heads are better than one.
Right.
And so I did, you know, get another doctor to look at my films and look at my records, look at my blood tests. Because second opinions don't have to be done in person.
Right.
They can be done by FedEx and phone. I don't know what PAL's official position is on this, but I think pretty much everybody should have a second
right.
opinion.
And what I'm also saying is if you're not sure, if you don't like your doctor, then you can always change your doctor.
Yeah, and especially you know. If it's one that you really feel on eggshells with and you feel you mm-hmm. can't ask questions of.
I say that if there's, you know, the question might be embarrassing to you, but just imagine how many questions they've been asked.
Oh, you can't
even...
possibly be the first with your question.
Exactly. And if you are,
the last.
And if you are, I want to know if I'm the first to ask this, you know, such question.
there's really no downside to it, right? I mean, it also sets up a kind of peer review. The fact that you're seeing another expert, just to get another perspective on things, just to see if there's some trial or another approach that is reasonable. And then I think each physician knows the other is looking at the case. So I
right.
think just human nature there, it's going to make everyone perform maybe a little better, be a little more attentive to the details. And
I think not just
yeah.
doctors, like we were saying before. I mean, I pretty much know... Like, I don't remember what they gave me for chemo because that was a while ago, but I am pretty proactive about my own health, whether it be just blood tests or today I had a bone density scan. So if there's, you know, like if I read something on, you know, say your website, even if it has nothing to do with my cancer, say, mm-hmm. oh, well, you know, chemo may cause
yeah.
osteoporosis. Well,
or neuropathy.
Or neuropathy, exactly. Something, as we all know and love, you know, that's something that I'd want to look into if I have it and ask the doctor, hey, what can I take? Is, you know, is the B6 going to work for me for neuropathy? I mean, obviously, sometimes they don't know, but there may be, you know, a patient that's where it's not a medical thing like a drug or anything. Like I have the massage ball is what I used a lot for my neuropathy. And that's something that you can buy. And if it works for you, great. If not, you spent $5 and it's not going to,
yeah,
you know, cause you any harm.
I think physical therapy is an excellent exception, you know, in complementary medicine where
right.
we help people to be open-minded, which includes being skeptical, right?
yes.
Against everything.
So this might be hype. This might be somebody trying to sell me something mm-hmm. and so on. But I think among all the complementary practices, I think exercising within your
oh, yes.
within your ability, of course, is just an excellent strategy.
Even walking, but make sure, like,
yeah.
like I always say,
anything,
make sure that your doctor yeah. approves if you're going through treatment.
Exactly.
More than anything that you can take, that you can swallow as a pill, exercise beats it
mm-hmm.
on all
exactly.
fronts. In fact, ASCO, which just completes today, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, had their about 30,000 you know, cancer experts from around the world come, and they present all their research and findings about cancer. And, of course, there was a lot of stuff about lymphoma as well, and we've been posting it at PAL. But one of the big things to come out of ASCO this year were new guidelines for exercise for all cancer patients.
Yeah.
The guidelines are saying that they want you to work up to about 150 minutes a week
oh, well, that's, yeah, that's
of exercise. And, it, you know, and of course, it needs to be something that you can do. It could be, and they actually broke it down. Some cardio, like walking,
right. mm-hmm.
swimming, some strength training. They said that 2 days a week of strength training, and then also some flexibility exercises. So that would be like yoga, tai chi, stretching, Pilates. You know, Pilates kind of goes both ways, a little
exactly.
strength, a little
mm-hmm.
flexibility. But they want you to kind of change it up and to work to doing about 150 minutes a week of exercise during treatment and in post-treatment.
And well, we're hoping that
the benefits are huge.
And we're hoping that people exercise even if they don't have cancer because it's very important.
Yes, we all agree with that.
but,
yeah.
in terms of you know undergoing chemo, because I did the opposite. I did all the wrong things, and I'm here and I'm cancer free.
Right.
Which is not to say don't you know try and make your situation the best that you can, but I would love to point you know one statement I'd like to make that people can take away from this podcast. As please don't get hung up that if you don't do everything perfect, if you're not stress-free and cheerful and positive every moment, that you will somehow
oh, yeah.
make yourself sicker
right.
or, you know, or bring on a relapse. No, nobody could have had more external stress and more extreme stress. Few people in this world have as much stress as I did during treatment and the year after. I'm perfectly fine.
Well, I think that goes for everybody. And, you know, we do talk about positivity and how that does help you. And I talk about my depression, too. It's like, yes, I've had days where I've been just great, and then there were days where I just, you know, Doug would come up to me and be like, what's wrong? And I'm thinking, well, you don't know what the hell I'm going through, so get out of here.
Support groups are good for that, to have somebody who does know what you're going through.
Exactly, exactly.
And will give you the space to be down when you're down.
And it's so surprising because, you know, at that moment, and I've told survivors this, at that moment you feel that there's no one in the world that feels the way that you do. And, you know, we had talked before the show that I'm on antidepressants and I, you know, they're great for me. If they work for you, like I said, with a doctor's approval, you know, whatever you need to do to make yourself better, even if it's just watch a great movie to make you laugh, I say go for it. I'm not advocating taking meds without, obviously, because I'm on the radio. You shouldn't listen to me for medical advice.
To chime in,
mm-hmm.
You know, I also went on, I used antidepressants while I was in treatment and
right.
needed them.
Exactly.
And it was a smart decision
right.
to how to mobilize my energy and mobilize, you know, my mind. And then, again, there's a balance,
mm-hmm.
okay? There's a great book by Dr. Jimmy Holland out of Sloan Kettering, and is, The Human Side of Cancer. And one of her chapters is The Tyranny of Positive Thinking. Thinking that you 100%, you know, 24/7 have to be up and cheerful
oh, no.
and fighting that cancer. It's not possible. It's not human. And Carl has a great way. What do you say about it, Carl?
I forgot.
You said don't stress your stress.
Oh, don't. Oh,
you know,
right,
don't
right,
add
right.
stress on top of the stress by saying, oh, my gosh, I shouldn't be under stress. But cognitive therapy is terrific.
Right.
I mean, I've become a huge, in fact, you know, one of the silver linings of cancer for me was when you have the existential blow that you do, facing your own mortality. Few people really face their mortality as young as you do when you get cancer.
Right.
And it just it upends your whole world, and it makes you think differently about everything.
It does.
But I was always a worrier. Well, now I really had something to worry about, right? But I discovered cognitive therapy and how to think differently about things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Picked up new tools and techniques. It brought about such a huge maturity to me and was such a big, you know, I am grateful to cancer for having discovered cognitive therapy and having discovered how to think about things in a way that I don't get as anxious,
mm-hmm.
don't get
exactly.
as depressed, don't go so far down. I really strongly recommend that.
Where did you find out about this? Is there a website that you can tell our listeners? Or
do you have what? I'll send you some. I think I have a couple good websites about
okay.
it. One happens to be British, by the way.
Excellent.
And there's a couple of books. And how about I send them to you and you can put them on your blog or something?
Awesome. That would be great. And you know, like we had a guest on the Vic McCarty show, which is the show I do in the morning here. And I can't remember her name for the life of me. But she said, you know what? You can be depressed and happy at the same time.
Yeah, it's what's your resting point? What's your kind of default position, as
exactly.
it were? What do you come back to? Yeah, you're allowed to be sad.
Of course.
You know, that's normal. You're allowed to be scared to death. That's normal. You're
yeah.
allowed to be discouraged. There are going to be moments when you hit the wall and you just, the idea of one more day of treatment, one more test, being poked or prodded one more time
right.
is too much to bear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to have those moments. Those are human moments. They're natural moments, but they shouldn't last too long.
Right, exactly.
You know, you should be able to come out of them and come back to a resting state, which is fundamentally kind of at peace or happy or, you know, I got a grip on things.
Right, and if you're not, then that's when you should talk to your doctor.
Seek
for sure.
Therapy.
Seek therapy, talk to your doctor, do, you know. Like I said, and the other thing that I advocate is, you know, find something that makes you happy. Because as you know, once you're in treatment, everything seems like you're in the cancer bubble. Like everything you talk about is cancer. What do I eat and how do I feel? And this medicine is making me feel like this. I like to say find your bliss, whether it's watching, you know, horror movies or funny movies. Maybe you knit. Maybe it's hanging out with your grandkids. You know, find something that makes you happy.
Yeah, and you'll have to redefine. You know, you need to do things that are meaningful. Everybody needs to do things that are meaningful
right.
to them and valuable to them.
Right.
And to keep their life going. So, but, you know, if you're a very active physical person, suddenly you're not able to be quite that active anymore, you're going to have to find things to do with the energy you've got and the level of concentration that you've got.
Exactly.
To give your life that kind of meaning. And it helps to be creative and flexible to help kind of look around
mm-hmm.
and see what other people do.
Right, and that's one of the great things about Facebook is you can post that. It's like, well, I'm really tired now, but I want to keep my mind active. What can I do? And then,
yeah,
you know,
Facebook, I think, fills a great need because
mm-hmm.
you can get different kinds of information, but you can stay in touch with people. You don't have to be so alone and isolated.
Right.
One of the bad things about being in treatment is that you tend to get a little isolated.
Yes.
And Facebook offers, you know, some solutions to that.
Exactly.
I think people also need to do things that are, you know,
you have to
that involve their hands a little, too.
You have to be out with people. I mean, we're not saying live in the cyber world here, either.
No, exactly.
You know?
It's all balance.
Exactly.
Right, Carl? Wouldn't you say that, Carl?
For sure. I'm just thinking we have a topic called anxiety and depression,
mm-hmm.
one topic, right? It's in the side effects section of lymphomation, and within that, we have some tips from Dr. Himley, who is a specialist in cognitive therapy. One of his quotes is I found very poignant. He said, "Depression has a lot of trouble finding a moving target. It's outstanding at hitting a stationary one."
That's true.
So, but I thought his talk was excellent. So we have some of the feelings, signs of stress and depression. which can affect, by the way, caregivers.
Right, exactly.
Caregiver depression is quite common, and a lot of these so-called psychosocial issues, they affect the entire family, not just the cancer survivor. It can be, and then when you become, I don't have to tell you, when you become depressed and anxious, your ability to be a provider for others, to do your work, to, you know, you have other responsibilities. The whole family is affected by the diagnosis. And
exactly.
There's really a big gap in what our medical services can provide in that regard, I think. There's a lot of people fall through the cracks. But places like Facebook, as you're as you've noted, are filling an important, are playing an important role.
Exactly. So, Carl, if people want to get a hold of you, where can they get a hold of you?
Lymphomation.org. We have an Ask Question button on the top of every page. Ask Question or Sign Guest Book. And from there, you can, that's the easiest way. Phone number is 610-346-8419. Those are the two ways that I can think of.
And Liz, if people want to get a hold of you?
A private message on the Facebook group on Patients Against Lymphoma.
Excellent.
They can also email me at dearlizzie, D-E-A-R-L-I-Z-Z-I-E, at yahoo.com.
Excellent.
They can chat, too.
Oh, yes, as we have. Instant message and everything. So awesome. This is great. Well,
there's also another webcast I thought was terrific that went, it was a follow-on to something you said. It was one of the speakers at the Lymphoma Ed Forum last fall. The Lymphoma Research Foundation does these absolutely fabulous things each year. They have the North American Education Forum. This year it's going to be in the fall in San Francisco. Last year it was in October. It was in New York, so I was able to go to that. And they had a fabulous woman who was a doctor, who herself was a lymphoma survivor. And she talked about, you know, how to get through it all emotionally. It was fantastic. And now it was called Lymphoma, a Survivor's Perspective. And LRF, Lymphoma Research Foundation, which is, you know, www.lymphoma.org, has this in their webcast, Lymphoma, a Survivor's Perspective, and it's Dr. Laura Lieberman, L-I-B-E-R-M-A-N.
This was great. I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. You can always find me on Facebook, like I said, because I'm a Facebook junkie, Mel Majoros, or you can become a fan or like the page, The Cancer Warrior, on EmpowerRadio.com. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. You can always email me, thecancerwarrior@gmail.com. And you know what? Life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.